Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
From Gadigal Country, I'm Brooke Young, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, a Trump card versus a red card. The US president confirms he's asked the head of FIFA to review a US player's suspension ahead of today's game against Belgium.
How do you penalize them for a game that hasn't been played yet? It's very unfair. You can't do that. So all I did was ask for a review. I didn't say you have to do this. This man is a smart, tough man, Gianni Infantino.
You'll hear from a FIFA whistleblower, and safe to say, she was not impressed. Back home, and Pacific leaders have condemned China's test firing of an intercontinental ballistic missile.
This has been a destabilizing event and certainly has drawn criticism from countries in the Pacific.
You'll hear from Minister for Pacific Island Affairs and Defence Industry, Pat Conroy. And Meta has fronted the Royal Commission into anti-Semitism. So what role do these social media giants play in tackling online hate?
People are consuming extreme and violence-inciting content without knowing that most of it's actually illegal.
All that coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the world football governing body FIFA has long told European nations to keep politics out of football. But now, the organisation itself has been accused of bowing to political pressure by lifting a one-match ban against the US's top striker, Folarin Balogun. Balogun received a red card and a one-game ban for stepping awkwardly on the ankle of a Bosnia and Herzegovina player last week in one of the more controversial and consequential decisions of the tournament. That is, until Donald Trump personally asked FIFA boss Gianni Infantino to review the decision, and the ban has now been suspended.
I understand sports really well, and that wasn't a foul. That wasn't even an infraction. Two great athletes crashed into each other and got entangled. And this referee, who is a little bit suspect, if you check his past, he made a call that nobody could believe, even people on the other side.
Donald Trump declaring there that he knows more about the sport than FIFA-appointed referees, bearing in mind he said in that same press conference that he didn't know a red card meant suspension. Well, those comments didn't land too well with Benita Messiades, a former Football Federation Australia leader who investigated FIFA corruption in her book Whatever It Takes, The Inside Story of the FIFA Way. She was up early watching the Spain and Portugal game this morning and gave Radio National Breakfast her take on Mr. Trump's intervention.
I think we could probably summarise it by saying that red cards have gone the way of the rules-based order because it's just... There's only been one other incident of it in World Cup history, and that was in 1962, which was later proven to be a case of corruption where that happened. And it's just unprecedented for a red card to be suspended from a leading player in one of the host countries. It's just unheard of.
What does it mean for the tournament? So this is a striker from the USA team and USA is trying to stay still in the tournament.
I think it could call into question the whole integrity of the tournament, particularly if the US go on to bigger and better things in it. They've certainly gone a lot further than they have in a long time. The irony in this also is that Folarin Balogun is actually a birthright citizen.
That's right. He's from the UK originally.
Exactly. Only a few weeks ago, Trump wouldn't have wanted him at all. So I think that it does call into question the integrity of the tournament. And I think what this clearly does is shines a light on the governance of FIFA. Whether it's a red card or not is almost beyond you know, that's really not the issue here. The issue is about the governance of FIFA and the fact that a powerful person in the President of the United States can call the President of FIFA and ask for a review of a decision or have a decision overturned. That just shouldn't happen. We all, as fans, have issues that, with referees and the decisions they make on the field. But we also understand those decisions are taken on the field and they stay on the field and we accept it.
How would you describe the relationship between the US president and FIFA? Previously, we had this FIFA Peace Prize that was presented to Donald Trump. What do we know?
Well, the Infantino has spent the past few years trying to get closer and closer to Trump, and he's obviously done so. He's awarded him a peace prize. He's not done what a FIFA president should have done when the referee was banned from entering the United States, and that is stand up for his referee for the World Cup. He allowed Iran to have to go to and stay in Mexico rather than stay in the US, which was where their games were based. So Infantino's shown time after time after time that he's more willing to curry favour with the President of the United States than actually stand up for the sport that he represents.
What sort of reaction have we had from the Belgian team and also from UEFA, which is the European Association? What have they had to say about all of this?
Well, Belgium FA has said that they're going to take all possible options. And the reality is that prior to the kickoff of the game at 10 o'clock, there's not much that they can do. The time has been so short. And that's why I said this is really an issue of governance, because what they can do is play a long game here and call in the resources of UEFA and the other member associations of UEFA to take this issue further in terms of the governance and the running of FIFA. Overnight, I've noticed that other football associations, particularly in Europe, have come in and supported Belgium, particularly Norway, Switzerland, and I think others will get behind them because those who care about the game and the integrity of the game, and putting aside, as I said, that referees will always make decisions that a lot of us don't agree with, you should not be able to change the course of a game through a powerful person making a phone call to the president of an international sporting body.
Is this story over?
I don't think so. And particularly when, you know, and this will depend on what happens with the United States and what's going to happen in a few hours' time when these two teams take the field. But it's also no surprise. I mean, the President of the United States was not able to accept the election in 2020, so it's no surprise that he can't accept a decision of a referee.
That's Bonita Merciades, a former Football Federation Australia leader who investigated FIFA corruption, speaking with Sally Sara. Well, this theme of countries collectively condemning bad behaviour has also found its way into the Pacific this morning. Australia and other Pacific nations have called out China's test firing of a nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile in the Pacific Ocean yesterday. It came just after Australia signed a defence deal with Fiji, as part of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's Pacific Diplomacy Blitz this week. But Pat Conroy, Minister for Pacific Island Affairs and Defence Industry, told Radio National Breakfast that he doesn't necessarily believe that these test launches from China were a direct response to that Australian-Fiji-Vivale Pact.
This has been planned for longer than that, to be honest. We've been monitoring a Chinese Navy task force group that was involved in tracking the launch, and that's been in movement for quite some time. So I think it's more likely to be coincident rather than linked, but obviously that's ultimately a question for the Chinese government.
A spokesperson for China's Navy said the test launch complies with international law and international practice. In Australia's view, is that a correct summary of what's happened here?
No, it's not, to be honest. This has been a destabilising event and certainly has drawn criticism from countries in the Pacific and Asia. Secondly, it's not consistent with the Hague Convention on ballistic missile testing, which would require more notice and greater information provided to countries. So we would continue to call on China to abide by the Hague Convention, which provides sort of instructions or guidance on how to do these sorts of tests.
Has the Australian government spoken directly to the Chinese government at a ministerial level about its concerns over the ballistic missile test in the Pacific?
Well, I'm not going to disclose every communication various levels of government have. We have communicated with the Chinese government and will continue to do so. They obviously informed the Australian government about the test before they did it with insufficient notice, to be honest, but they did provide that notice.
How far in advance of the tests was Australia notified? Was it only a matter of hours? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's a fair assessment.
What do you think about that?
Well, we don't think it's world's best practice. Best practice is to follow the Hague Convention, which it has longer notice, also provides information about probable flight paths, where the missile is expected to land, things like that that actually provide a lot more transparency. We've been very clear that we're seeing the biggest military build-up in our region since World War II, and it's not been accompanied by sufficient transparency. And so this is another example of that sort of event occurring.
Are you concerned this test could act as a deterrent to other Pacific nations considering security agreements with Australia?
No, I'm not, Sally. This is something that can destabilise the region, but it doesn't take away from our efforts to implement what the Pacific leaders have called for, which is Pacific security to come from within the Pacific. And you're seeing that in action right now with the Oceans of Peace Alliance announced by the two Prime Ministers, Albanese and Rambuka, yesterday, building on the alliance with PNG that will come into force on Wednesday when Prime Minister Marape visits Brisbane with Prime Minister Albanese. What you're seeing from the Albanese Labor government is a significant elevation in our relationships with the Pacific family and working together to advance our mutual interests. And that's why we've doubled the number of alliances Australia has had prior to 2 years ago, and they've been with Pacific countries. Australia is safer and more secure now because of what we're doing in the Pacific.
Do China's actions make it more or less likely that a regional security alliance will form, like the one proposed by Solomon Islands PM Matthew Wale?
Oh, look, I think that's a question for each individual Pacific country. We made it very clear that we turn up, we listen to Pacific priorities and act on them. And if one of the priorities of the Pacific leaders and the people is a regional treaty along the lines Prime Minister Wale has described, we're up for that. But we're getting on with talking to each individual country in the region about what we can do to support their hopes and aspirations, whether it's the Vavale Treaty we've just signed with Fiji that will help support their aspirations around health, education, people-to-people links, growing their economy, or the Nakamal we signed with Vanuatu only last week, or the work we've done with Tuvalu, Nauru, or PNG. We're massively elevating our relationship with the region because our peace and prosperity depends upon a peaceful and stable Pacific.
You're in Ankara representing Australia at the NATO Leaders Summit. What's your focus this week?
My focus will be a couple of key messages. One, every war now is global in nature. So a war between Russia and Ukraine has massive impacts in our region. The conflict in the Middle East obviously had implications. So my main message is there's no such thing as a limited regional war. They all have global implications, and therefore the globe should act collectively to try and prevent them. My second message is that Australia is significantly increasing our defence spending to match the strategic environment we're in. And thirdly, that we're really interested in deepening our industrial collaboration with NATO countries. That means we'll get more work done on getting advanced equipment for the Australian Defence Force, but also more job opportunities for local industry.
Pat Conroy is the Minister for Pacific Island Affairs and Defence Industry. Well, to hear the reaction from the other side of the political aisle, James Patterson, Shadow Defence Minister and Liberal Senator for Victoria, joined the program. And Sally began by asking him,
do you believe this was a direct response from China to the deal that was signed between Australia and Fiji? What do you make of the timing?
No, I think it's unlikely that it was directly responsive to that, because military exercises like these take weeks, if not months, in planning. However, I think it is consistent with the People's Republic of China's approach to the region, which is not only destabilising and unwelcome, but also threatening and coercive. And part of the reason why they undertake these tests is for the demonstration effect. They want Pacific Island nations, they want countries like Australia and others in the region to know they are capable of exercises like these, and the reason why is they want to intimidate people in the region, and we should be very clear that we won't be intimidated by it.
A spokesperson for China's Navy said the test launch complied with international law and international practice. Did it, in your view?
No, I share the concerns that Pat Conroy just aired on your program, that it is not consistent with best practice, that there was very minimal notice given of just a couple of hours and very little details given about where it would be fired from and where it would be fired to. It's not how the professional men and women in the Australian Defence Force exercise. The only thing you can say is it at least gave more notice than their previous live firing exercise in the Tasman Sea when the People's Liberation Army Navy circumnavigated Australia, and they gave no notice at all, which required commercial aircraft to divert their routes to avoid the firing range.
Are you satisfied with the federal government's response to this test so far?
Yes, I am so far. I think they've made it clear that Australia does not welcome and does not approve of this conduct. And I think it's important that the PRC understand Australia's perspective. I think we would be within our rights to seek an explanation from the PRC about why they conducted this in the way they did and the time they did. And I think we'd also be within our rights to make representations, not just on our own behalf, but on behalf of our Pacific family, because the Pacific has made it very clear they want to be a conflict-free zone. They also want to be a nuclear-free zone.
The signing of the agreement yesterday between Australia and Fiji, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said that, quote, China doesn't engage in geopolitical rivalry or seek selfish political gains, and it's hoped that Australia will, quote, truly respect the independence of Pacific island nations. What did you make of that response?
A typically florid statement on behalf of the Foreign Ministry of the People's Republic of China. Of course, Australia does respect the sovereignty and independence of our Pacific Island family, and we enter into arrangements like this on the basis of respecting the sovereignty and self-determination of our Pacific partners, who have freely and willingly agreed to enter into these relationships with Australia because they believe it is in their national interest to do so. And it is partly because of the coercive and intimidated behaviour of the PRC that Pacific Island nations want to enter into these durable relationships with Australia.
The Oceans of Peace Alliance in the Pacific includes mutual defence obligation that would require either country to respond should the other come under military attack. Will this alliance make Australia safer?
Yes, I think it will. Speaking very directly, Australia's national interests would be grievously damaged by the establishment of a presence from a country like the PRC in our region of a naval port. That is the strategic circumstance that many Australian military planners have been concerned about for some time. And arrangements like these, bilaterally entered into with our Pacific partners, reduce the risk of that happening. I think it's important that we continue to seek further bilateral arrangements like these, and also that we explore multilateral arrangements with the Pacific, as the Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands has proposed, because they will be even more durable and even more likely to protect our interests.
In your view, is there a risk that this test by China may intimidate some Pacific nations and prevent them from signing further agreements with Australia?
I think it's possible we'll have the opposite of that effect, if that was what the intention was. I think it demonstrates exactly why security in the Pacific is best dealt with by members of the Pacific family, of which Australia is one, and why we have a mutual interest with Pacific Island nations of sending a strong message that this sort of conduct is not welcome in our region. I hope it builds further momentum for proposals like Prime Minister Wale's proposal for a regional security pact, and the opposition offers our unconditional bipartisan support to the government if they want to pursue initiatives like that.
James Patterson, Shadow Defence Minister and Liberal Senator for Victoria. Well, the fight against hate online is back in the spotlight this week as the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion continues to take evidence. This latest block of hearings is focusing on the role that traditional media and social media play in tackling online hate. Now, yesterday, Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, defended its systems for identifying and removing hateful content.
If the Jewish community is experiencing the fatigue described in the evidence, that is a terrible thing for the Jewish community. We want our users to have positive experiences that do not consist of views of violative content. It's something we're monitoring. If there are spikes in prevalence or trends, it is our commitment to stay on top of that and do what we need to do.
That's Meta's Global Policy Director Ben Good speaking yesterday. Now, online violence prevention organisation Moonshot is working with governments around the world to develop digital tools to weed out hate. The company's director, Teresa Raja, has given evidence to the Royal Commission. And so when she joined the program, Sally asked her to give us a bit of an idea of the scale of online hate that we're now seeing around the world.
What we've seen is a really exponential rise in the amount of content that's being created, that's being circulated, consumed. And what we're finding is that the spaces in which people can actually operate online to actually voice extremist hate and violence inciting content has also rapidly evolved. So there's fringe networks and websites and platforms that pop up on the daily, and so it's why it creates such a complex problem for any government or agencies involved in trying to tackle online hate.
So how do we go about reducing the amount of this material online? Is it education of people so they don't do it in the first place? Is it the social media companies and their algorithms and online tools catching this stuff before it's widely distributed? How do you do that, given the scale that you're talking about?
The scale is so large and the issue is so complex that there's no one solution. And that's why, of course, there's a role for platforms to take down content for moderation. There's the regulatory frameworks that are required to hold platforms accountable. But from Moonshot's perspective, there's so much that can be done from a prevention perspective. So that's empowering people first with information around how these online spaces can be so dangerous, because most people are consuming extreme and violence-inciting content without knowing that most of it's actually illegal. And what we're finding also is that when people are in these online spaces, they're also not aware of the different tactics in which they can be manipulated, recruited, and influenced to kind of become very fixated in their real-world grievances that they then take and amplify online. So from a prevention perspective, there's kind of two things that we aim to do and that we believe you can have impact on. And that's first kind of a societal level education around manipulation techniques and empowering people to really apply a critical lens to what they're seeing online, what they may be consuming. But then there's the more targeted reach, so outreach to individuals who are engaging with violence and violence inciting content and extremist content, to provide them with an offer of support that says there is an alternative to what you're viewing and consuming online, and that there's real-time confidential support that's available where they are geographically, where often it's people just needing to speak to someone about the underlying drivers that have taken them and motivated them to seek out this really extreme content.
So we're hearing some of the executives from the social media companies giving evidence to the Royal Commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion. What do you make of the kind of responses that they're giving? Are these companies doing enough? Do they have the capability to do more to weed out some of this extreme material?
From our perspective, we've worked with platforms and alongside the major social media platforms. And our view is that it's not our position to comment on their own characterizations of their responsibilities and the investment that they make in trust and safety initiatives internally. But what we really advocate for is that there is still always a need and a real chance of being effective if you're building a prevention infrastructure alongside these platforms. So we're not relying solely on the platforms to make those changes and to actually go out and create change internally that's going to safeguard people. You can actually do that without waiting for the organisations to, you know, somewhat fail or not perform on their responsibilities. I think holding them accountable is very important, and that's why I think a lot of what's come up at the Royal Commission and what we're hearing from the eSafety Commissioner are really important initiatives. But from our perspective, this is work that we think is really impactful, where you can actually do that work now and you don't have to wait on platforms to cooperate.
Teresa Raja, the Director of Online Violence Prevention Organisation Moonshot. And that's all from today's edition of The Breakfast Wrap. Sally Sara conducted all of the interviews, which were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. This episode of The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Kathy Van Exstel and Katie McAllister. I'm Brooke Young. Thanks for listening.